So this week, we get what I think is a nice break in Leviticus. That Leviticus is, for us moderns, often very slow-going, tough reading. Sacrifices so far from our lives and the enormous detail that the book goes into about the laws of sacrifice and the priests and how they have to stand and where they have to be is hard often to break through and get meaning that is relevant for our lives. But this week, Parshat Achremot, and more importantly, Kedoshim, we get really a gem of a chapter hidden almost at the center of the book. It's not hidden, it's the center of the book. I don't know why I said that. It's a whole chapter. And it begins with the phrase, Kedoshim Tihiyu. You shall be holy for, and then it goes on for, Ki Ani Adonai Elohecha Kadosh. I have it somewhere in here, but we'll look at it later. Which is, because I, Lord, the Lord your God, am holy. You shall be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then we get an entire chapter of laws that, for the most part, have nothing to do with the priesthood. In fact, before it even says Kedoshim Tihiyu, we get a very odd sentence that happens very rarely, where God tells Moses to gather all of Bnei Yisrael, which the rabbis understand that to mean not just the leaders, which is often the case. Sometimes they say gather Israel, and the rabbis understand that to mean just the leaders. Sometimes they understand it to mean just the men. Sometimes they understand it to mean just the fighting age men. This is men, women, children, the whole shebang. Everyone comes together like at Sinai. Yes. Including the Erev Rav. So I don't know exactly what you mean by that, because there's a lot of debate of what people mean by Erev Rav, but they're... There's a half a verse when we leave when we're leaving Exodus that says, and 600,000 Jews left Egypt and a mixed multitude went with them, an Erev Rav. And who exactly those people are is like up for a lot of debate. The biblical scholars want them to be the Egyptian monotheists that Judaism probably grew out of, who were fleeing the rising power of Egyptian polytheists who had won whatever civil war was sort of happening at the higher power. The rabbis want them to be the people who knew a good bet when they saw one. You don't bet against Muhammad Ali, you know? or Moses in this case, who left with them. But and so, yes, I think the assumption is they would be, by this point, they would be integrated with the rest of the people. The rabbis also like to blame the Erev Rav. Whenever the Jews are whiny and say, we should have just died in Egypt, the rabbis like to blame that mixed multitude. They were really the ones who were being whiny. The real Jews, they were good. All right, yes. Yeah. Right, or it means mixture. Many. So it's also a fun, so I was not going to spend that much time on this, but it's also, rabbinical students are often called Erev Rav also, because it's the evening before they're a rabbi. Rav is the, and so there's a lot of jokes about us being a riffraff mixed multitude, but I'm a rabbi now, so I don't have to mix with that bunch. All right. Kedoshim Tihiyu. So I wanted to spend some time. I've got a really, I've got a heavy packet today. I don't think we'll get through most of it, but you can take it and read with it what you want. I want to spend some time trying to figure out what is, in Judaism, what is holiness? Holiness is a word kind of like spirituality today. That means basically whatever nice thing you want it to mean, but sort of God-like and religion-y. So let's spend some time and get some context, some meat around that word to see how it's used by different rabbis. And we'll start, obviously, not on the first page, but on the third page with Rashbam. So in the past, I've tried to describe Rashi as the guy who doesn't try to interpret the Torah, but tries to read the text of the story as a story itself and what is happening to those characters. If that's Rashi sometimes fails at that and gets midrashic anyways, his grandson, Rashbam, He never writes more than three sentences about anything, basically. He has no interest in what the meaning of the text is, only in what the text is saying, in trying to understand every word of the text to fit in context, to tell a consistent and coherent narrative about what's happening in the story. And so we'll begin with him because he's usually the easiest to understand. Often, sometimes he's really compelling, sometimes he's a bit of a throwaway, but I like him here, at least for understanding holiness in Judaism. Someone fill up to reading, page 3 there at the top, please.
Speak to the holy.
No. So, at the very top.
Rashbam?
Yeah. So Rashbam here is giving the simplest understanding that is core to the rabbinic understanding of Judaism, which is holiness is doing mitzvot. And not mitzvot in the sort of contemporary do nice things for people way we use the word mitzvot. When they say mitzvot, they mean the laws of Judaism. Everything from the non-nice ones, like making sure you don't have both wool and linen in your clothes, to the visiting the sick, there's a hierarchy of mitzvot actually, but doing those things, that's what it means to be holy. God puts it here. And also that makes sense. We're about to get a whole chapter of basically unrelated laws. You can spend time creating patterns, but the truth is that they're all stretches to try and group them in any way. And so it makes sense that God is giving you a heading. You shall be holy, and the content is all of these laws, and the implication for Rashbam is, in fact, all of these laws, not just the ones in this chapter, but it makes sense to go here because we get, kind of like in Parshat Mishpatim back in Exodus, just a long list of laws. Great. Let's go to Rashi. Why not? Rashi takes this in a very specific bend. Someone fill up to reading where it says, "You shall be holy." Please.
Speak to a whole Israelite.
So yeah, skip down to the bold where it says, "You shall be holy."
Oh.
Just three lines.
Oh, you shall be holy. Mm-hmm. Keep yourselves apart from forbidden sexual relationships, even from the thought of transgression. Note that wherever sexual limits are mentioned, holiness is also invoked. When the priests are warned that they shall not marry a woman defiled by harlotry, it is because they are holy to their God, for I, the Lord, who sanctify you, am holy. See also the instructions about the high priest. A widow or a divorced woman or one who is degraded by harlotry, such he may not marry. Only a virgin of his own kin may he take to wife, that he may not profane his offspring among his kin, for I, the Lord, have sanctified him.
So now there are a couple of laws related to sexual indiscretion in this chapter, but by far there's no way to say that's the theme of the whole chapter. It's not even the next two that come are observe Shabbat and honor your parents, which God willing has nothing to do with what Rashi is talking about. So the question is, where is Rashi coming from? So if that's the case, if Rashi's reading this onto the text, why is he doing that? Okay, so Rashi is projecting here. That Rashi, you shall be holy, is like command to hold back on whatever the hardest thing is. And for we're getting a glimpse not of Judaism, but of Rashi's own personal struggles in life. And that is the sexual indiscretion ones, that maybe he's got a really attractive maid or something like that. There's a whole, we're not going to do it here in this class, but there's a book or two written about the status of female servants in the Talmud, and there are a couple of not explicit but very implicit stories about rabbis and their maidservants. Yeah.
Rashi's talking about the priests and who they may marry. This is still all about men. Women don't have no choice. Is that correct?
Yeah, for the most part. In the sexual indiscretion stuff, there is some, like, there are some that just women can do, it seems. The adultery is a lot easier for women to do than for men to do. I guess there's some choice in that. Because men can technically marry multiple wives, if a man sleeps with a woman who's not married, it's not adultery, he just married her. Whereas if a woman is married already and sleeps with someone else, that's adultery. So maybe there's something in there. But for the most part, yes, we're still male-focused. And certainly Rashi is male-focused, yeah. Although there are lots of rumors and like suggestions that his daughters wore tefillin. There's a whole thing about Rashi's daughters wearing tefillin and that being a major source of... he only had daughters, and Rashi is one of the greatest sages in all of Jewish history. And so there's a lot of talk about the status of his daughters. And pro-feminists say, see, the great ones understood what was to be, and his daughters were involved in Jewish life equally. And the, I don't want to say the anti-feminists, but the separatists, let's say, the separate spherists, will say, yeah, if you're Rashi's daughter, you can put tefillin on. but go ahead, yeah?
I think in English as opposed to Hebrew. And I was just reading this, and I thought something that was play on words in English, where he says, Rashi says, they are holy to their God. And I thought, why not spell the word W-H-O-L-E-Y? Holy.
Yeah, completely.
Like completely, totally committed.
Excellent. That this is
an English play on words. I'm sure it's not part of the Hebrew.
Right. I don't know how you would make that work, but it's still a nice trash. I like that, too. Nice. Excellent. Yes. So what is it? Cause what? So we are not spending time on this yet, although we'll get to it in a little bit. One of the primary ways that holiness is understood biblically is separate, above, purer somehow, beyond, and so the priesthood is the model for holiness in the Bible, and therefore they do everything possible to set them aside as different and other, as...
Like a ram should be without a blemish, the woman should be
pure. Literally, actually, yes, exactly that. It is interesting to note that the rabbis didn't take that upon them. The rabbis eventually assume the role of the priests, functionally. They become the leaders that the priests were, and they basically, they don't spend any time trying to do that for themselves. Yes. Right. So the... Of course it's unfair. It depends on where you're coming from, priority-wise. If your priority is that all people have a fair shake, individuals, then absolutely it's not fair and you should change it. But if your priority is that you create a national system in which the priesthood has a built-in level of respect, a built-in level of separateness, a built-in level of aboveness, then there is no differentiation because the individual in this case doesn't matter. What matters is the system, and therefore having a white-dressed bride is crucial for the high priest. In the same way that we take great account in people choosing who they're going to spend the rest of their life with, whereas in that case, actually Judaism, far more than any other Near Eastern religion, has a lot of say for the bride in who they will eventually marry. But still, relatively speaking to where we have now, it's like who you'll marry, there being preconditions is like not about refusing the one you love. It's just about narrowing the pool of people that your parents would choose for you. Yes?
Is there any proscription that demands that the priest remain virginal, so to speak, until they're married?
Until they're married? Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Everyone's supposed to stay virginal until they're married. In fact...
How about the priest?
The priest specially?
Yeah.
But is that explicit?
I think not any more than anyone else. I can't think of any place that it's... I mean, Bible's not entirely memorized in my brain. although have you heard of the pin test? Real Torah scholars will take a Torah and roll it a little bit and put a pin anywhere on the Torah and tell you every letter that goes through. I've never seen it done, but it, you know, it's a pretty cool thing. I'm not that guy. I can't think of anything that would put them extra special. What's actually interesting, the modern age has created a real difficulty, and Elliot Dorff wrote a little pamphlet about it for Judaism. Until 50 years ago, let's say, no Jewish leader conceived of anything between not touching and sex. Maybe kissing, maybe. But there are a range of ways people are physical together, physically intimate together, and some of the writings about suggesting for young couples that Judaism says you can't have sex before you're married, or if you do, it's like there's a bit of an in-between. It basically says you shouldn't have sex before you're married. It's not necessarily a problem if you did, as long as you marry that person. But then the modern papers say, basically, if you're in a monogamous, committed relationship, we would love for you to get married. But if you're not going to get married, we understand if you want to think about the range of physical intimacies that exist between a couple and hold off on one until your marriage will be our suggestion as rabbinic leaders for you couples. Yes.
And who are the harlots for?
Who are they for? So the role, maybe one day I'll do this. I have, I think, a great packet on the role of harlot in rabbinic literature. There is, I will tell you a brief story, and then we'll get back to this. There's a story in the Talmud that begins with, there was this guy, Rabbi Eliezer, who used to visit all of the prostitutes. Visit all of the prostitutes. And I don't think this was like a house call. I don't think they were studying Mishnah together. That's how the story begins. So the place of the prostitute throughout rabbinic literature serves this sort of, and throughout the Torah, the harlot often is the one who moves the plot along in one way or another, in the right way. In Joshua, and Judah, and Tamar, there's kind of a thing about it. She pretends to be like, and so there is this odd place that basically feminists write about it as saying that rabbis are like the fact that women affect the world. It like seeps through, and they don't know what to do with it, and it becomes the harlot, basically. That this is the role in which women break their mold. So we don't want them to be doing it. We're calling that person the harlot, because that way, you know, it's still not something you should do, but we have to recognize that, and occasionally women are the ones who take charge and like move the story along, as the case may be. Other people just understand that like the harlot occupies inherently, all stories need this, need someone who exists outside the system, because all stories or good stories have a system being one way and it changes to be another way, and you need someone outside the system to change the system, and so harlots inherently exist on the border of the system. Yes, we like just made it to Russia.
Recall, yeah. For whatever reason, that in the Torah was a derogatory thing. It was kind of like a matter of fact, as opposed to a derogatory.
I would say if 10 is like are the best thing you can do, the most righteous, and 0 is like the worst thing you can do, harlotry is probably like a 4.5. Like, it's certainly not a good thing. It's not, you know, it's not idol worship, although there is some concerns here and there that it's going to lead to idol worship, because, you know, if you're a harlot, there's a reasonable chance you're also an idol worshiper. Definitely not nice. But it's not like, basically, the other thing feminists write, and I think this is probably legitimate, when you get a world founded by men, prostitutes aren't going to be that evil. Basically, that's the gist of what some of the writers say, is that probably some of the people have visited a prostitute on occasion, and therefore they don't feel proud about it, they're not thrilled about it, except for Eliezer, apparently. It goes. Never mind. Another time. No, concubine is some sort of in-between status, because there's some sort of slave status involved in concubine.
Realistically, what are we talking about?
So they seem to also only be in the Genesis stories. Once you get later on, you either have to marry the girl or not. It seems
Abraham
to be the case.
First son before another
concubine. Right. So Genesis, yes, there seem to be some sort of concubines. By the time we get to like Deuteronomy and into the later books of the Torah, it seems like concubines aren't a thing anymore in Judaism. At least I can't remember any other case where that's the status. And in consistently for all three families, although that doesn't happen for Isaac and Rebecca, the concubine status is they are producing children for the actual wife. In fact, it says over and over again, take Hagar and she'll make a son for me, Sarah, that it's a surrogate status. The fact that it doesn't almost proves that it just shows the problematic nature of doing this sort of surrogacy process, but hypothetically, Ishmael should be Sarah's son, as is the case with Bilhah and Zilpah later on. That the maybe because they're like the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, but they're close. They're like subsections beneath Leah and Rachel. Yes.
So what happened to Solomon?
Solomon is he's a great. The rabbis like to point out that they believe Kohelet is written late in Solomon's life, and he says, don't have many wives. And Solomon is said to have 250 something like that wives in his time.
So there were wives rather than concubines.
Yeah. What?
How many women?
250.
We grew up by thinking 1,000.
So maybe 1,000.
It's a mere difference.
Yeah. What, once you hit 150. Or I suppose once you hit 365. Okay. Yes. There is clearly some sort of status of slavery or indentured servitude. The line between slavery and indentured servitude is very fine in the Bible. That like it seems like you're not really supposed to keep slaves forever unless they want to be slaves forever. Let's get into some more holiness. We've been wandering around a lot. So the one of the things I want to point about Rashi, we'll read one more rabbinic commentary and then we'll read some modern ones, is that I think that what Rashi is pointing out by picking sexual transgression as the thing holiness is he's pointing out that holiness is inherently amorphous, that there isn't necessarily an easy way to say what holiness is, but it clearly seems to be something about restraining yourself, something about something that is maybe permissible but feels kind of icky, that it's a word basically covering the things that you can't systematize but don't do. It's the, you guys will probably all know, who's the Chief Justice who said, I can't define pornography but I know it when I see it?
Justice Stewart.
Thank you. It's that kind of thing, that like, I can't tell you what it means but I know it when I see it. I can't tell you what holiness is but I know sleeping around isn't it. So let's go now. So again, I apologize, but in order to fit it in properly, we're going to start on page 2 and wind up on page 1. I'll read because it's kind of a poor copy. Nachmanides is, again, a Spanish commentator. He is before the expulsion, but not more, much before the expulsion. Famous, they used to have these debates where Christian scholars, for a long time, their path to proving that Judaism was wrong and Christianity was right, their plan was, I'm going to argue Talmud with you. I'm going to show you that the Talmud tells you that you should be Christian. Just like a pretty gutsy statement on a side note. But if either the Christian people won or they killed you. So they had like a pretty reasonably good arguing style, I suppose. And so Nachmanides famously got like an order of protection from the king. So he could do this debate, but they weren't allowed to kill him, and he won the debate, and basically there was a long period of hiding and court battles to try and protect him because they wanted to kill him because he won the debate. Whatever. Great scholar. He's also probably the founder of mysticism as we have it today. He's really the first guy who starts publicly talking about it. He doesn't use it here, but he has a famous phrase, which is Hamevin Yavin. Every so often, he says something wildly confusing and then ends it with, those who understand, understand. meaning that like those who are schooled in the ways of mysticism know what I'm talking about. All right, you shall be holy. Rashi understands this to mean that the Israelites are to separate themselves from forbidden sexual relationships. But in the Sifra, from which Rashi presumably derives this comment, it says merely, separate yourselves, full stop. So even Ramban, or Nachmanides, is a little confused as to why Rashi got to this sexual forbiddenness and says, well, I guess maybe it came from this quote in the Midrash, but that quote actually says, separate yourselves. It doesn't say separate yourself from forbidden sexual relations. Similarly, with reference to, you shall sanctify yourselves and be holy, for I am holy, this Sifra explains that God as saying, just as I keep myself separate, you too must keep yourself separate. In my opinion, this does not refer to keeping separate from the sexual transgressions, as Rashi thinks, but to the separateness ascribed throughout the Talmud to the people it calls Pharisees, that is, separatists. I'm not good at wherever language Pharisees come from. I assume it's Greek to know whether or not it actually means separatists, but Ramban assumes that Pharisees means separatists. Meaning those who exercise self-restraint. You see, the Torah proscribes immoral sexual relations and forbidden foods, but it permits intercourse between man and wife, eating meat and drinking wine. So there is license for a man of appetite to steep himself in lust with his wife or his many wives, or to be of those who guzzle wine or glut themselves on meat, or to discuss all sorts of vile things as long as they involve something that the Torah does not explicitly prohibit. One could therefore be a scoundrel with the full permission of the Torah. So, after giving the details of those things that are specifically prohibited in chapter 18, which is another chapter of laws, the Torah now gives us a general commandment to restrain ourselves from excess, even in those things that are permitted. He goes on to give examples, but we can pause right there. This is one of Ramban's famous additions. He brings it up in a couple of other places. He has a famous open letter to the Jewish community, which basically says, the law allows you to be a terrible person and a glutton. Hmm. That's what Jewish law allows you to be, which is why we don't have just Jewish law, we also have Jewish values. That the Torah tells us, you shall be holy. And that is a responsibility not to just do the law, the letter of the law, but also to learn from the law, to grow from the law, to hold yourself back. And here he means basically really a life of self-restraint in every way, which is interesting because we are so often a religion that focuses on actually being able to enjoy the physical pleasures of this world, that that's an acceptable thing. And Ramban seems to be on the strictest end of that spectrum, that yes, it's okay to enjoy the pleasures of this world, but in the most limited way possible and with God in mind at every step of that process. Okay, so these are the rabbis. We're talking roughly till about 1500 CE. So we're talking negative 100 BCE. I don't know that double negative is if I say it that way. So before 100 BCE and up till about 1500 CE, this is the sort of some of the range of opinion. I also brought for you a brief thing about Hidur Mitzvah and another little thing. Let's jump ahead to today. What are modern people saying about holiness? And I want to start on page 4. Those of you who've been coming week to week know this is a favorite commentary of mine. I bring it often. The Torah, a Women's Commentary. Mm-hmm. It's a green book. It's been published pretty recently. I really think it has a unique set of understandings and or takes on the Bible, so which is wonderful. And so this is one of the things they do is they give a couple of 1 to 2 page essays. So the Eitz Chaim is wonderful because in the back it's got some great essays, but they are heavily academic and they're not short. They're not, for academic articles, they're not long, but for shulgoers, they're a little long. This one has really short, easy to read articles. And she does a great job here of asking who, when, and why of holy. What does she see? Her name is, I forget who wrote this one. Does it say? Yeah. So those are the editors of the whole commentary, and this is Elise Goldstein. I don't know who she is. wrote this specific article. But she asks, what is the Torah telling us about the who, when, and why of holiness? Does someone feel up to reading the second paragraph on page 4? Please.
First, who is to be holy? The entire people is addressed. Kol Adat B'nei Yisrael, all Israel is told, you shall be holy, for I, your God, am holy. Not just the priests or Levites, not only the women or men, but everyone was part of this command to be holy. The 16th century commentator Rabbi Moshe Alshech asks why such important rules as the ones that follow upon this verse are not taught person by person, group by group, rather than to the one large assembly. He suggests that the opening of Kiddushim emphasizes the ability of any Jew to attain even the highest and noblest principles of Judaism. Thus, these laws and the paradigm of holiness are not only for a select few, but for everyone.
Okay, so hidden amongst the laws of the holiness of the priesthood is this chapter, which is a reminder that the priesthood then becomes a model for the rest of us. Like, we all have to be holy. In fact, in Exodus, God told us, you shall be a nation of priests. That's your job, to be a nation of priests. And so everyone needs to be holy. So who is everyone? And not everyone altogether, but each individual. Great. Who wants to read when, the next paragraph? Please.
When are we to be holy? The verb to hew in verse 2 can be read, and is often read, as a command, be holy. But it's grammatically a future form, you shall be holy. The implications are, be holy now, and you shall be holy in the future. Thus, holiness is a daily struggle in the here and now, as well as a future yearning.
So the brief two words, kedoshim tihiyu, you shall be holy, or you be holy, that tihiyu can really either be read as the command or as the future prediction. And the drash here is that both are true, that kedoshim, you shall be holy, like it, you must right now struggle to be holy, and in the future there we are moving towards holiness. Who wants to read why, the next paragraph? Please.
Why are we to be holy? God is holy. The 16th century commentator Rabbi Obadiah Sforno notes that this verse teaches us that we are to remember and act in the image of our Creator as much as that is possible. Philosophers refer to this concept by the Latin term imitatio Dei. We try and imitate the divine. As God cares for the widow and orphan, so do we. As God rests on the seventh day, so do we. In imitating God, we can achieve a higher sense of purpose, and our actions will reflect the ongoing concern of the divine for the world. In imitating God's holiness, we make holiness a behavioral idea.
So why be holy is that when we try and be holy, when we try and imitate God, we have meaning in our lives, and our actions can affect the way we think and feel. We can start thinking and feeling holy if we start acting holy. Okay, the rest is lovely too, but not what I want to go into today, but I couldn't resist bringing it to you. We'll do one more from this, from one of the editors. I want to read just a paragraph on page 6, the first one, that she does an interesting job of trying to figure out what the through line is through these laws. Like I said, all of the laws in Leviticus chapter 19, there's not a lot of connection between them, but that you can, and people do try and find ones, and I think hers is really interesting. Does someone feel up to reading that first paragraph there? Please.
Stranger from one must love, and of course, to God.
So what she does is turn basically all of the study of this parsha on its head. That for 2,000 years, 3,000 years, people have looked at this chapter and seen a list of different categories. That one of the things you can argue the chapter does is set up categories of people and separates them. And she argues, but inherently in doing that, we're not just separating, we're actually drawing the connections. The reason why you have the categories is to show what your responsibility is to different categories or what your relationship is to the different categories. It is a reminder that yes, separation and keeping away from certain things and the separation that Ramban is talking about of separating from your desires is one path to holiness. But relationship is another, and not only does that work in the text, but we can all know that's true in our lives. That we may gain a sense of holiness and pride from refraining from doing something that we really want to do, even though we know it to be wrong or unsavory or something like that. That if we do that often enough, we really do get a sense of better than the mundane. In an appropriate way, hopefully. Not in a holier than you, but holier than I could have been kind of way. But we also gain that same sense of holiness, of deeper connection to God when we are with loved ones, when we take a relationship to a new level, a friendship that goes deeper than it once was, a vacation that brings a family closer together, a deep conversation that goes late into the night, a shared experience, a moonlight walk, whatever the thing is, we've experienced that at some point. At least I hope everyone has. And if not, I encourage you to go outside. your hand or you're just waving? Go ahead.
Well, if I recall, this is 19 begins with what you said, you shall be holy.
Yeah.
And then it says, then you shall honor your parents.
Yeah.
And you shall teach these to your kids, and you'll keep the showers.
Okay. Right, so one thing I didn't bring, one commentary I didn't bring, either I don't remember now if it's in here and we didn't read it or if it's not in here, it talks exactly what you're talking about, that both in the Shema and here with Kedoshim Tehiu, we're given a list of things to do, but they're all under the rubric of a command to feel something or to be a certain way, which is different than a command to do something. And I think for us in the modern world, at least today, that's often the most kind of compelling. Because laws in and of themselves are nice sometimes, but unless they're leading somewhere, they're hard for us to understand. But in the rubric of, let's say, understand Shema and Ve'ahavta, love your God, and then it tells us to do tefillin, and it tells us to teach our kids stuff, and it tells us to do mezuzah, and we attach talit also, then this group of laws become about loving God. Then it's not just about choosing the prettiest talit or wrapping tefillin the tightest, but it's about when you do it, trying to intend yourself, to focus yourself towards loving God. And the same thing true here. When we should give one a little bit farther down. We get the law of peyashicha and leket, which is how agriculturally speaking we need to feed the poor. Basically, it's one of the systems in place for feeding the poor, and we should do that anyways because the poor need food, and we believe in being a good person. But this chapter puts us in mind that when you do that, it should not just be a burden that you're taking on yourself, but it should be, or the best way to do it, is in the mindset of moving towards holiness. 100%, I think it's an excellent point. Yes?
But you never get there. It's only about strength.
Yeah, so I like to think of it more as a range. It's not that you never get there, it's that you always get more. To maybe some sort of pure holiness or even connection to God, but I'd like to believe, or at least I do believe, that you ever played horse? It's a basketball game where you play and you progressively get more letters until you, when you get the whole thing, the idea is the other person gets to call you horse. Mm-hmm. You go shot for shot. It doesn't matter. But the I think of holiness in somewhat the same way, in that you can sort of earn the letters of the name as you go. You never get maybe all of holiness, because you can always reach farther and reach stronger and get closer to God. But that doesn't mean that the steps you've taken are irrelevant and you haven't gotten anywhere. So it is both true that you never get there, but it is also true that you get closer.
In 12 steps, we say, progress, not perfection. Because we can't demand perfection if humans do not take us to perfection.
We can demand progress. The only thing I would say in that kind, I don't know about it specifically in the 12 steps, but that kind of thing, is that I also don't want to give up on perfection.
I feel sorry for the fellowship of Christian athletes who want to perfect themselves like Jesus. It's impossible.
Right. Except that it is good to reach for the impossible.
Strive.
Yes. But in order to do that, you need to believe, to a certain extent, that there is something like... I think we're arguing semantics, but I think that this tension is inherent in holiness. I think you're right to point it out. In the notion of holiness in the Bible, in these modern understandings of holiness, I think it was the part that Don read, Kedoshim Tihiyu, both is a command and is a statement of fact about the future. And what she doesn't say, which is even more interesting, I think, is that also the Bible doesn't really have tenses. It actually has moods, which, I don't know, sounds ridiculous to me, but that's why they chose to make it, which means this is not the future, but the imperfect, which means that it is an ongoing task as opposed to a finished task. So in that same way, you put all three of these together, we've got an absolute future hope of some sort of salvationed, saved, perfect world that we are striving towards and may be able to reach one day, in which we don't have to have war, you know, war and sickness anymore. And we have a command to work and strive daily, ongoing, and we have the idea that it is not a process that does not end and keeps going and is forever part of the thing. So I love having all those things together. Okay. I got 10 minutes, and I really want to do two more things before I lose you. The first is I want to read a little Heschel. So Abraham Joshua Heschel, he taught at the seminary for a long time. He escaped Germany. His facility with language is unparalleled. His ability, for someone who English isn't the first language, and to write in English the way he does is unbelievable. He also is not such a linear writer. Why don't you move up? I can't make the sun move, but...
I'm sorry,
okay. So I didn't give you a page yet, but we're going to go to the page after page 6, which apparently didn't get a page number, even though page 6 did. Yes, I suspect it is page 7. He wrote in God in Search of Man a number of things about holiness. And whenever you're getting to these amorphous concepts, he's the best, because he'll say things that are what you probably already think, but he'll say them smarter, and he'll say them layered in Jewish text, and he'll say them in a way that makes you think it more than you thought it before. So we'll begin with, the Bible is holiness in words, the top of page 7, please. So I think about this when I think about Dr. King. So Martin Luther King Jr. is a moving, amazing speaker. We don't have people like that I can think of presently. There aren't, that I know of, orators whose great claim is orators and have a real place on the national field because they're great orators. And this is already, he marched with King, actually. So this is already 50 years ago. But I think it's true that for whatever reason, maybe because the information age, we are now inundated with words. Maybe it's because we feel like good oration is just stock language that's been tested and whatever, and isn't the like true meaning of what people want to say. It is true, I think, for us, that when we hear something, when we hear a set of words that transition us out of whatever is the regular and the mundane, we really are moved. And what's more, most of our words are spent not doing that. So I think it is a remarkable push for someone whose words were amazingly powerful to understand or think about the fact that the Bible is not a picture book, it's not a movie, it's not a play, it's not a dialogue, it's not meant to be performed. Even when we chant it and we put it to music, we're still just saying the words. And the chant is just a way of breaking up the sentences and is its own midrash on the text itself. That holiness of words, that at our core, kadoshim tihyu is a command in words, and you shall be holy, means how are you going to use these words? How are words in your life, language, going to elevate your life? Let's get down to the last paragraph on that page. Please.
A moral deed unwittingly done may be relevant to the world because of the aid it renders unto others. Yet a deed without devotion for all its effects on the lives of others will leave the life of the doer unaffected. The true goal for man is to be what he does. The worth of a religion is the worth of the individuals living it. A mitzvah, therefore, is not mere doing, but an act that embraces both the doer and the deed. The means may be external, but the end is personal. Your deeds be pure, so that ye shall be holy.
So you shall be holy, kadoshim tihyu, means that you have to act with intention and not just with purpose, not just for the sake of the thing. And which is really tricky, because it also means that you can't do nice things just to be holy, because that ultimately corrupts itself also. You have to do nice things for the sake of being nice, but also with the intention of trying to be holier. Yes?
That sort of reminds me of Kavanaugh and Kevanaugh. And
Keva, you're okay. Close. Yes.
<Yeah. laughs> In other words, when you really are mindful of what you're doing and really into it, and acting, whether it be in prayer or what, visiting the sick or whatever you're doing, and not doing it just because it's the words say you should do it.
Right. So the best definitions I just heard, I should quote her, Miriam Heller-Stern, who's the dean of the Fingerhut Ed School at AJU, she gave a great definition that Keva is our security blanket. Keva is the layers of tradition. Keva is the safe space we can go that has been set out for us, that has been laid on a silver platter for us, that is comforting, that is what we know, is the foundation. And Kavana is that spark of newness, that amazing transition into something that is different. It is what we bring that is unique and different to the table. And when you have both of them, that's where the most meaning comes in. Great. We'll do one more paragraph from Heschel. Yes. Yeah, like kavua.
What is
it's like set. A makom kavua is your set place, is like that's where you always are. Or a Mifgash Kavua is a set meeting, like every week at this time you have this meeting. So it's the same way that every day you have this prayer, the Keva is this prayer. The Kivun is a direction or an intention. Kavana is when you say Hit Kavanti something, I mean I meant to say some that as opposed to that, or I intended the meaning to be X. Yeah. That's a good way of seeing it. Let me just pick a good one. All right, let's end on the last one there. Page 9. You want to read one more Heschel paragraph?
The preciousness?
Yeah.
The preciousness that loyalty to the mitzvot bestows upon the life of the individual or the community
In other words, it is an inoculation against cynicism. That what he is saying is that when you do Judaism and you do it right, at the end of it you feel uplifted, even though you know that you didn't do anything or that you didn't accomplish all that much, that in our greatest days of and he marched with King in focusing on the greatest injustices of the world, we're not going to solve them. Our back members are being attacked by the sunlight, but we can at the end of the day do a little, and that Judaism is our comfort, is our chance to feel a little better about it. So I want to end with a case study. Rabbi Joseph Talushkin is he's a prolific writer. He's famous for taking rabbinic text and making the and writing them in a way that is for someone who doesn't study rabbinic text. He is famous for taking the wisdom of the Talmud and rephrasing it in a way that is more accessible. And one of the most famous quotes we get in this chapter of the Holiness Code is, "You shall not put a stumbling block before the blind." So I'd like to, actually, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna wrap up, but I'm gonna sign that one to you for homework. It is your packet. If he is readable by everyone, which I think he is, I am going to encourage you to take it home and read it with you. I will rise now for Kaddish to Rabbanan, and if anyone has any other questions, I'm happy to stick around for a little bit, but I wish each of us a week of holiness. I'm also giving this sermon this week on this topic, so if you're around for Shabbat, certainly would love to see you. Yitgadal v'yitgadash.